All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's JNEB Journal Club, the second one in our fall semester series. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB and glad to have you with us today. A little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar control panel, you'll see a handout. Our presenters have made the slides available, so please download those as you can use those to take your notes and follow along. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block. There's also going to be a point in the webinar where the presenters are going to ask for a little bit of feedback from the audience. So when we get to that point, go ahead and type those answers in the question block as well, and then we'll see your responses to the question that they're going to pose. When I close out the webinar, there will be a follow-up survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future journal clubs. We are actively looking at the topic that we would like to cover for the spring semester, so your feedback is appreciated. And then watch for an email. I'll have that out on Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording, as well as the slide handout and the CEU certificate that you're earning from your attendance today. So our moderator today is Ginger Quick. She is in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at Rutgers University.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. And so we're really excited today to have both Dr. June Matthews and Dr. Paula Dworczyk today present. Dr. June Matthews is an associate professor in food and nutritional sciences at Brescia University College and an adjunct research professor with the School of Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies at Western University in London, Canada. And her research interests include peer nutrition education, food skill development, and the broader concept of food literacy. We also have presenting Dr. Paula Dworczyk. She is the chair and associate professor in the School of Food and Nutritional Sciences at Brescia University College and a visiting associate professor at the Schulich Interfaculty Program in Public Health, which is the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry at Western University. And her research interests in particular are looking at the school food environment, direct food observation, peer nutrition education, food skills and use, and diabetes management. So it's a pleasure today to have them speak on the topic of university students intend to eat better but lack coping self-efficacy and knowledge of dietary recommendations.
Thank you, Ginger. It's Dr. Paula Dworczyk here. I'm going to get us started, and then at a couple points throughout the talk, we're going to switch places. So it may take us a minute. We are actually going to get up and switch seats just so that we're closer to the phone and you can hear us. Okay, so thank you very much for inviting us to speak about our paper, and I hope that you find this further discussion a little more insightful into the background of it. Okay, let me try to advance the slide here. That part isn't working. How about this? Okay, there. Can you see the next slide now? Okay. So we're just going to start with the learning objectives we are hoping to address today, and they include the audience being able to question the usefulness of implementing complex dietary recommendations as found in Canada's Food Guide, given that most individuals cannot correctly identify specific recommendations for their age and sex. We're also hoping the audience will recognize the importance of targeted nutrition interventions to facilitate uptake of relevant dietary recommendations at all life stages. And lastly, to reflect on what types of nutrition education would be effective, considering that high intentions do not necessarily progress to actual behaviors. So we've all heard of the Freshman 15 by now. And as Miha Lopoulos has reported and asked the question, is it real? So in his paper, it was reported that a 15-pound weight gain was not the norm. However, students are gaining weight at a much more rapid rate than the general population. And we also know that students' diets are typically low in calcium, folate, and fiber, and high in sodium and fat. Altogether, their low nutrient intakes are likely representative of low intakes of foods from the fruit and vegetable group and the milk and alternative groups, as well as high intakes of what we might refer to as other foods. There are many potential reasons for these intakes, including many barriers to healthy eating that have been reported in the literature, and we're not going to focus too much on those, but I do want to acknowledge them. We also recognize that reported awareness does not translate into positive behaviors necessarily. Nevertheless, we were interested in seeing if students actually know what the recommendations are. From the literature, we could see that only 37% of Canadian pharmacy students could correctly identify vegetable and fruit recommendations, with fewer correctly identifying milk and alternative recommendations at only 13%. For adults, the recall of recommendations was even worse for vegetables and fruit at only 18%, while 53% could correctly recall milk and alternative recommendations. Thus, our objectives were to use a cross-sectional survey design to identify whether students could correctly identify Canada's food guide recommendations related to vegetables and fruit and milk and alternatives. We also wanted to determine students' intentions and self-efficacy to consume more vegetables, more fruit, more milk and alternatives, and less high-calorie foods and beverages. Okay, so what is Canada's Food Guide? We recognize that perhaps not everyone would be as familiar with Canada's Food Guide as they may be with their own food guide. So we just wanted to give you a snapshot of it. It's actually a 6-page document, and you may not get that sense here, but it folds out. So it's a very long document, and the two side pieces fold in. So on this slide, you can see the front page of the food guide with the rainbow on it, and then in addition to that, you will also see the inside front page and the back page. And then on the next slide, you'll see the inside section, which is where we would actually see all of the food group recommendations. And I just want to make a note that this full 6-page document is actually what is shared with the public. This is what dietitians hand out to members of the public. It's what teachers use in elementary school or high school to describe the food guide. So now we're going to look a little bit more closely on that inside left panel to look at the actual food group recommendations. And so from this, you can see there's quite a bit of detail in the number of servings of each food group for each age and sex category. So there's 6 age categories altogether, and those are represented across the top. And then for the latter 3 categories, for teens and adults, the recommendations are also split into male and female recommendations. So this is the question that we wanted to get your input into, and that is it useful to deliver age and sex-specific dietary recommendations, as in Canada's Food Guide, to the public? And we just want you to put a yes or no answer. If you want to add a little bit more, you can. But this is what we're talking about here is it useful to deliver these specific recommendations to the public? So go ahead and put your responses into the question box. And we're going to carry on with the presentation, but we just wanted to get your input on that. Okay, so I see a few coming up, and I'll just carry on, and we'll see where we go from here. Okay, so now we're going to show you one of the tables from our study, and it's a little bit busy, so I'm going to try and walk you through it. So this is table 3, and in this table we wanted to show that our study showed that less than 45% of students, and in some age and sex categories as low as 11% of students, could correctly recall the serving recommendations for vegetables and fruit and milk and alternatives. And this did not vary by student program of study or for those who had taken a food nutrition course down here. So you can see that these p-values, I don't know for sure if you can see my cursor here, but these p-values were not significantly different. So they weren't very good at correctly identifying the recommendations, and this didn't seem to vary by discipline or having taken a food nutrition course. Interestingly, the proportion of students who claimed to meet the recommendations was much higher. So now we're looking, I mean, it's not huge, really high, but now we're looking at somewhere between 42 and 59% of students claim to meet the recommendations. And the highest proportions of those were in the health sciences and those who had taken a food and nutrition course. So we can see that when we're talking about whether or not they claim to meet the recommendations, those who are in a health science discipline or had taken a food nutrition course are more likely to claim that they meet the recommendations. So just looking back at the question we posed, we had a few responses, and everyone said yes, it is useful to deliver them. It's useful to deliver them, but we're left in this dilemma where people, students in particular, are not able to correctly identify them. So now Dr. Matthews is going to take over to discuss some of the framing and messages of food guides in general.
Thank you everyone for inviting us. It's, we're delighted to be here and we hope you'll find the presentation interesting. So other countries have begun to focus on simpler messaging for the public, and we're going to go through a few of those. The assumption is that these simpler guidelines may help individuals make healthier dietary choices. And these simpler guidelines may also allow for broader diet-related messaging, for example, eating with your family or eating local foods, you know, grow your own foods and so on. So we're going to take a little tour and look at some of these. So what we've done, we thought it'd be interesting to take a look at other countries' guidelines. For the purposes of our presentation, we've grouped them loosely into four categories that relate to the graphics used and the level of detail provided. So first, we're looking at cultural or other symbols. Second, we're looking at food or cooking symbols. Third, we're going to look at combinations of graphics plus guidelines. And finally, we're going to look at food plate models. So our first group here, and this is just a loose grouping, and you could group them any other ways, but we've put a few together that represent cultural or other symbols. So here on the left, top left, you can see that Thailand is using a flag, which is basically an inverted pyramid. An interesting cultural aspect of their pyramid is that rice, vegetable, and even meat servings are measured in spoons. In the Bahamas, the lower left, the graphic takes the form of a goatskin drum, while in Barbados, they use a map of their island as the graphic for their guidelines. Note that neither Bahamas nor Barbados include food group servings in their graphic. Although Canada's food guide uses a rainbow graphic, the guide for our Indigenous peoples takes the form of a circle with four quadrants to represent an Aboriginal medicine wheel. Germany also uses a circle. Their nutrition circle is divided into groups with single numbers representing the quantity to consume, with one being eat the most and six being eat the least, plus water in the middle. The size of each segment was calculated from the percentage of the total weight of food in the daily plan. Note that only nutritionally desirable foods are shown. Their food-based dietary guidelines also include a 3D food pyramid, which you can see in the lower right. The Arab Center for Nutrition in the Kingdom of Bahrain actually created dietary guidelines for Arab countries in general, and they've created it as a food dome. However, you'll see later that we were able to find other countries that use different graphics. Some of the dome images actually include servings, so you'll see the servings on this one, and some of them don't include servings, so that varies. In China, they're using a pagoda as their symbol, and you'll see that quantities of food from the different food groups are also included. The pyramid graphic, which was pioneered by the USDA in 1992, actually evolved into more than 100 different versions. Here we can see that Israel and Vietnam have chosen the pyramid as their graphic symbol. Bangladesh also uses a food pyramid, but they also have a food plate in which they show suggested portions that are quite exact. So for example, you can see 53% for starches, 7% for what looks like a guava, 4% for maybe some side dish. So it's quite specific proportions. Finland uses a pyramid as well, and they too include a photograph of a sample meal as a second document. Fiji's food guide resembles the rainbow graphic similar to Canada's food guide, except they have used three food groups and we have four. A pineapple image is also included on a separate page that includes their food and health guidelines. In Venezuela, they use a spinning top, and you'll see that Japan also uses the same graphic. Venezuela and Canada are similar in that they have created a separate guide for indigenous peoples. So here's Japan's spinning top. In contrast to Venezuela, however, Japan includes recommended numbers of servings per food group. Interestingly, the servings are not quantified except to say that it is, quote, the approximate amount of each dish or food served to one person, end quote. So now we'll come to our second grouping of food guides, and these symbols are related to food or cooking. So Qatar, for example, is using an open shell for their food guide, and they've displayed the food groupings within the shell. Qatar is one of the first countries to incorporate sustainability principles into their guidelines, and the overall message they want to send is eat healthy while protecting the environment. In Saudi Arabia, date palms are a source of food, and they are also highly valued possessions. So they've used that as their graphic. Palm trees can live for hundreds of years, and they're passed down from generation to generation. The Saudis have included servings and some guidelines, but they're a little difficult to read in the trunk of the tree there. Antigua and Barbuda, similar to Fiji, have also used a pineapple as a symbol for their dietary guidelines, and you can see there are no serving sizes listed. Guatemala, Guyana, and Honduras have all taken some form of the form of a cooking pot, and they've included the typical foods in their countries inside these cooking pots, which could be called a family pot or a stew pot. In the Dominican Republic, on the left there, they're using a mortar and pestle along with a cutting board, so some typical tools that are used in their kitchens. Note the prominent photograph of the baby breastfeeding on the cutting board at the bottom there. On the right, you can see that Grenada is displaying its food groups inside a nutmeg. So our third grouping includes a few examples of combinations where they've included the graphics, but they've also included their guidelines on the same page. So similar to other countries, Oman is using a pyramid. However, they've included dietary guidelines on the same page. For example, three messages within that guideline relate to women's increased needs during pregnancy and breastfeeding. Others relate to gradually increasing portions for children under the age of five, because the guideline starts when children are aged five and up. Recommended servings on this guide are portrayed as a minimum, with a plus sign to indicate more is necessary. So, for example, in the bread, grains, and starches group, it states, quote, for people who do hard physical activities, 12 portions will be necessary, end quote. Jamaica and Belize also include both a graphic and a list of dietary guidelines on a single page. While physical activity is highlighted on both, neither guide includes the recommended number of servings. Our final grouping includes food plate models. I'm sure many of you will recognize the American My Plate graphic. Plate models can be useful because whatever foods are chosen, they can be modeled after these proportions. Both Singapore and the Philippines use food plate models. Again, neither these nor the MyPlate model include recommended numbers of servings on their graphics. Similarly, the UK's Eat Well plate displays food groups as proportions, but does not include the recommended number of servings per food group. Now, although we're certainly not a country, we like the food plate model so much that we created one for our peer nutrition education program that we created at the university here called FRESH. We believe it's a useful guide for students to use at every meal. Note that we did not include the number of servings. I'll talk more about our FRESH program later in the presentation. The last country I'll discuss is Brazil, and I'm sure many of you are aware of the groundbreaking strides that Brazil has made with their 10 dietary guidelines. They have not incorporated, to my knowledge, a graphic symbol, but they do include a number of photographs of sample meals that align with the food plate model. So here are the first five of Brazil's dietary guidelines. And it's inspiring to see that their recommendations not only advise limiting or avoiding processed and ultra-processed foods, but also eating regularly in appropriate environments and in the company of others. Recommended number of servings, again, are not included. Brazil's last five guidelines are also remarkable in that there's a recommendation to be wary of food advertising. It is also heartwarming to finally see people being encouraged to share cooking skills, number seven up there. We have general dietary advice on Canada's food guide as well, but the information is spread out over three pages. Page 2, for example, includes specific recommendations for children, women of childbearing age, and men and women over 50. Page 5 includes recommendations related to each food group. For example, choose vegetables and fruit prepared with little or no added fat, sugar, or salt. And the back page of our food guide makes recommendations related to physical activity, reading food labels, and limiting foods high in calories, fat, sugar, or salt. So Dr. Dworczyk is now going to tie this back to the results of our study.
Okay, thank you. So let me get myself set up here. Okay, so now you may be questioning, do we still need age and sex-specific guidelines if they are so complex and no one remembers them? So in very few of those guidelines that Dr. Matthews showed, were there actual serving size recommendations? And none that I could see had age and sex-specific recommendations except for Canada's food guide. So we ourselves question how useful they are if the population cannot remember them. But nevertheless, we do have to remember that they are used in other ways. They are used in planning menus in long-term care homes and other institutional settings. They are also used to conduct surveillance
of population-level intakes. And while some of the simpler food guides are easier for individuals to implement, for example, the plate method, it is also important to recognize that different life stages have different nutritional and food group needs. So this is more of a rhetorical question. How do we actually ensure uptake of age and sex-specific dietary recommendations? And how do we ensure that as people move through these different life stages, that they will get the correct information at the appropriate time? Our data shows how the recommendations that are introduced in elementary school may be recalled at later life stages. So let's take a look at that. So for review, our study surveyed university students who can be as young as 17. Thus, we typically have two age groups that we're looking at when we're looking at university students. We have those who are under 19 in the teens and those who are 19 and over listed in the adult section. And the two food groups that we assessed in our study were the vegetables and fruit and the milk and alternatives. And you can see that as adolescents transition to adulthood, they require more vegetables and fruit and fewer milk and alternatives. So this is table two from our study. And you can see that regardless of age, students generally recall the vegetable and fruit recommendations to be about 6 servings per day, which is the requirement for children aged 9 to 13 years. And that is probably what they would have learned in elementary school. So although we can't say definitively, it appears that that's what they're remembering. For milk and alternatives, the recommended serving students recalled was about 4 servings per day. It did fluctuate a little bit more than the vegetable and fruit servings, but it would be about 4 servings on average, which is only in alignment with the students who are less than 19 years old. Those students that are 19 years and older would only require 2 servings, but it seems that at this age, when they've just transitioned into the adult category, they haven't yet adjusted to these new life stage recommendations. They haven't internalized them yet. And again, perhaps it's because they're recalling recommendations that they were taught at a younger age while they were in school. So to come back to the question, how do we ensure that people in different life stages will get the correct messages at the appropriate time? Let's look at our data on students' intentions and self-efficacy, and then we'll talk some more about some nutrition education strategies. Oh, sorry, I was meant to highlight those for you. Okay, so in Table 5, we reported on students' intentions to consume more vegetables, fruit, and milk and alternatives, and less high-calorie foods by sex, discipline, and whether or not they had taken a food and nutrition course. So in relation to vegetables and fruit, students intended to consume more, with females generally having stronger intentions than males. This is good, obviously, but remember that they did, and by they, I mean the students, did have a lower perception of the recommended servings per day than they actually needed. So that may mean that they are consuming even less than the 6 servings per day that they thought was recommended. So they're intending, therefore, to consume more. With respect to milk and alternatives, students had lower intentions to consume more milk and alternatives when we compare it to vegetables and fruit. However, their intentions were still relatively high, especially for the older students, considering that the recommendations for milk and alternatives are lower for those age 19 and older. Is it possible that older students may aim to over-consume milk and alternative products? This draws attention to the concept that they do, in fact, need to know the age-specific recommendations. Otherwise, their intentions could be inappropriate and difficult to achieve. We also know that awareness does not necessarily translate into positive behaviors, as we noted in an earlier slide. And in the behavior change models, such as this simplified model of the theory of planned behavior, the framework is such that behavioral intention is necessary for behavior. But we know there is an intention to behavior gap. So we turn to another theory to help us understand how we might overcome this gap. And here we have the social cognitive theory, which also identifies that several factors will impact intention, such as outcome expectations and self-efficacy. But this model also acknowledges that the environment, self-efficacy, capability or skills, and self-regulation will have an impact on an individual's ability to move from intention to behavior. And that's one of the reasons why we also wanted to measure self-efficacy. So if we look at our data on self-efficacy, we measured a version of self-efficacy called coping self-efficacy, where we asked students to report on their confidence in making these dietary changes when they're under stress, as we know students often feel that they are under stress. Here, students reported reasonable self-efficacy in consuming fruit, but had lower values for vegetable and milk, at least for females, we especially noted that. The lowest self-efficacy, however, was for avoiding high-calorie foods and beverages. With these lower coping self-efficacies for certain behaviors, it helps us to understand the target audience and to design interventions which address the barriers faced by students. I mentioned stress already, but lack of time is also an equally important barrier. So let's discuss some other considerations for nutrition education. Knowing the intentions and self-efficacy of your target audience is helpful, but we also need to address differences with sex. For example, men may not be interested in limiting high-calorie foods as it may not conform to traditional male identities. What else can we use to appeal to them? Perhaps we could focus on strength and endurance, and that may be more successful. Similarly, we have mentioned we need to find a way to get the messages out about specific food-based recommendations for particular life stages, and that's important to keep in mind. We and others also believe that continued focus on practical, for example, how to plan and prepare nutritious meals, as well as contextual skills, for example, within time and financial constraints that students, for example, may have. So focusing on these practical and contextual skills will assist any target audience in mastering the behavior. And the last point we have here, but I'm sure there are others that we could make, relates to influencing the food environment. If we can incentivize healthy eating behaviors, for example, with reward cards that they do often for coffee and other beverages, but in this case for healthier items, we may be more likely to be successful in enabling behavior change. And now Dr. Matthews is going to finish off describing a little bit about what we've done here at Western.
Thanks, Dr. Dortzik. So what we did was we published a paper on a program that we created at Brescia. It's called AFRESH. And just to give you an idea, too, that we are, Brescia University College is an affiliate university of Western University, and Western is a larger university, so that's where it's being implemented primarily, just to give you a better picture of how this works. So we recently published a paper in the Canadian Journal of Public Health on the development and implementation of the AFRESH program. Briefly, under our supervision, our graduate students develop the program, and our undergraduate students deliver it. We have a very strong partnership with Campus Food Services, and we work closely with their nutrition manager, Anne Zock, to implement the program on campus. AFRESH has grown substantially over the last 6 years, from a handful of peer educators to a team of 50, plus an executive team of 10. We've provided the citation here if you'd like to read more about it. This is a postcard that we distribute across campus, some information on our program. The front of the card is on the left of your screen. FRESH stands for Food, Resources, and Education for Student Health. Our program takes a multi-strategy population health approach. Thus, on the back of the card, which is the right side of your screen, we list some program components. So starting at the top, FRESH Approved is a point-of-purchase labeling program that identifies healthier options on campus. Next, the FRESH Education component is our busiest area. By request, our peer educators deliver dozens of interactive cooking demonstrations and presentations every year to students, staff, and faculty. We also run a website, which you can see there, and several social media platforms. FRESH Facts are healthy eating tips displayed on dining hall tables. And last but not least, we have a FRESH Frequent Buyer card, as Dr. Dortzik was talking about in terms of incentivizing healthier eating. So the FRESH Frequent Buyer card promotes or has a program where students who purchase 9 fruit, dairy, or salad items get the 10th one for free. We've increased from 430 cards redeemed in 2012 to 10,800 redeemed last year. That's a lot of free fruit and milk. So here you can see our team at work. In addition to interactive cooking demonstrations on the top right there, we also have interactive games on the bottom left where students can win small prizes, for example, FRESH branded pens, tote sacks, lunch bags, et cetera, for correctly answering questions about food and nutrition. So these questions are created by our students, and then they can ask these questions of students who come up to these displays or interactive cooking demos, and then they win a prize if they get the answer correct. We've had great success with our interactive crepe demos. Young men in particular are at first very shy to even try making a crepe because they've never done it before. Once they've done it, however, they invariably take a picture and send it home to their mothers. The guy on the left is really into it. So, in summary, we've discussed some results from our survey, and we explored other dietary guidelines. We've also shared how we are trying to improve university students' health through our FRESH Peer Nutrition Education program. We hope that our presentation has prompted you to question the usefulness of implementing complex dietary recommendations as found, for example, in Canada's Food Guide, given that most people can't correctly identify specific recommendations for their age and sex. We hope that you will recognize the importance of targeted nutrition interventions to facilitate uptake of relevant dietary recommendations, and particularly at different life stages. And finally, we would like you to reflect on what types of nutrition education would be effective, considering that high intentions do not necessarily progress to actual behaviors. We thank you for participating in the webinar, and we welcome your comments and questions.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Paula Dworczyk and Dr. June Matthews, for a lovely presentation. I know that you guys have put a lot of work and effort, and I'm actually really curious to look into more depth about the FRESH U kind of initiative you've taken on your campus. I know if anybody's listening in and has any questions, definitely feel free to write them in, and as we'll go, you know, pose them to both of you. One question I have for you is regarding to the FRESH U kind of initiative you've taken on your campus. I was curious, I know you have the FRESH U cards that the students will use on campus. Is it only for on-campus venues? Can they use them anywhere else, or is it only like in the dining halls? I was just curious to know how that worked.
Do you mean specifically the fruit and dairy cards?
Yeah, the fruit and dairy card where you buy 9 and get one free.
They can be used in the dining halls, which serve the students who live in residence, and they can also be used in the campus eateries, I believe they call them, which is where any staff, faculty, students, or anyone visiting the campus can purchase food. So they are in both places, but they cannot be used off campus altogether.
Okay, got you. And then also the peer educators, I know that they're heavily involved in the Fresh U. Are they only nutrition majors or health science? I'm just curious as how do you recruit these peer educators to be involved?
They are only nutrition majors, and okay. It's really a program that we've tried to make sustainable by recruiting people in the earlier years and having them gain experience and work their way up to eventually in their third and fourth years being on the executive team. And the executive team really is instrumental in organizing the whole team. This week they're planning the orientation for all of the fresh members. So even returning peer educators, but also new peer educators have to undergo about a two-hour orientation about the program, and there's an interactive cooking demonstration so they can get a sense of what they will be doing when they're invited to various campus groups to conduct these.
And our students take their food handler certification course, and they can't do the food demonstrations unless they've passed that course. And so every year that's a requirement. We also, the students can only get in this program by application. And so it's become sort of the go-to club, I would say, on campus for our small campus here. And it's a great experiential learning opportunity for the students. But it's the value of it is the partnership with hospitality services. If we don't partner with the food service people, we can't expect these things to be implemented. And so we have this really, and it took us a few years to develop that partnership before we got to the point where we could, trust each other and work together. Now, some things go ahead a little bit without our input, but we have good trust in our colleague there, and she is the person who facilitates all of these cooking demonstrations. You know, we're not there every night when they do these cooking demos, but it is Anne. And so they learn to work with another, sort of supervisor. And but all of the environmental interventions on campus, we also have a vending machine intervention and so on. It comes through a partnership with food services.
Gotcha. Great. Okay. No, go ahead. You're going to say anything else?
I thought there was one other small part of that question that we might not have gotten to yet.
Okay. Gotcha. Maybe. Yeah, and then have you been able, since you've implemented this, kind of evaluate kind of like eating behaviors on campus? Has it changed? Do you know?
Well, that is a difficult thing to evaluate. We have started to look at sales data of the fresh approved items versus the non-fresh approved items, and we are working on that analysis and manuscript, but it is a challenge. In our residences, we find it's mostly first-year students, so every year it's a new student body.
Right.
It would be challenging to evaluate that, but we can look at what food is being sold. And we are in the process of doing that.
Yeah, and going back to kind of like the change in the food behaviors of the students, I don't know how it works at your university, but I know at least a number of universities here in the U.S., oftentimes students live on campus the first year and then they're, off campus the following years. So I'm wondering how you'd be able to still kind of grab and keep on those students who might be off campus that might not be interacting as much with the dining hall and being able to improve their behaviors. But
one thing that we're doing this year, the very first time, and we don't know how it's going to work, but it's a huge undertaking, is that we recognize that we have not been targeting the off-campus students. And one of the challenges there is that the cooking demonstrations are held in the residences very close to the dining halls for food safety reasons. They're not held, in the middle of anywhere in any campus building. So that's an issue. So we're getting those the resident students. The off-campus students, they're a little bit harder to reach because if they walk through the University Student Center, we're not able to do cooking demos there yet because of food safety. But there's a new wellness education center that the university has put quite a bit of funding into, and it's all based on peer education. So we've been invited to be sort of the nutrition, quote-unquote, experts, and our students are going to be staffing those desks in that little central area, you know, 2 days a week. And that's helpful. We'll be able to have small events there. We'll be able to have themed talks or whatever, maybe some interactive cooking demos as well. And that's going to be our opportunity to target those off-campus students, which we haven't had a chance to do before.
Yeah, that's great. That's good to hear. We do have one question from a listener. They were wondering if you prefer one theory over the other. They're wondering if you prefer the social cognitive theory rather than the theory of planned behavior. I guess the real question is, why did you choose that theory in particular, the social cognitive theory?
I guess, you know, everyone has their biases, and I have mine, so I'm going to answer from my perspective.
Okay.
I do prefer the social cognitive theory over the theory of planned behavior because I feel like it brings in those constructs that address the intention to behavior gap. We can't just think that if people intend to do a positive health behavior that they're going to do it. There might be a lot of barriers that they face. There might be, you know, if we're talking about food preparation, they may want to eat more vegetables, they may intend to eat more vegetables, but they don't have the skill to do it, then that's going to be a barrier. And we have to acknowledge and understand those barriers and equally the facilitators that may help people jump that gap from intentions to behavior.
And one thing that I'm just going to add to your thought on that, but I know that the environment, and you've kind of, you know, included this as one of your major pieces at your university campus, but the environment plays a huge role too, and I think that's one thing that's kind of lacking in the theory of planned behavior versus the social cognitive theory takes into account the environment. So,
absolutely.
But just to add that piece. So, great, thank you. So, would you give? Do you guys have? Do either of you have any advice for anybody, any researcher or health educator, when it comes to, you know, taking on something to this magnitude with tailoring certain nutrition education materials or programs? Maybe any lessons learned from your experiences that you might want to share?
Well,
be patient.
Yes. It does take time. You know, when we're talking about Fresh and the program we have here, we really started thinking about that in 2010. And we didn't have budgets. We didn't have partnerships. So it took a long time before it really got up and off the ground. And, I mean, primarily we're academics, so we're researchers and educators, but our mandate isn't necessarily to educate the whole student body on healthy eating. So we really have to work with other people to help deliver that message. And I think that's the same. It doesn't matter where you're working. If you're working in public health, you can't do it all yourself. And many people already know this, that you have to develop these partnerships and work together to be able to develop something that is sustainable in the long term. And so, you know, without that partnership, we're not the decision makers in food service, so we wouldn't even have a hope of having an impact there. But together with the partnership, we really can work toward changing the food environment. And so Dr. Matthews already wrote a little note here that when we think about nutrition education, we should think about nutrition education more broadly, and Contento from the States has published in her textbook that nutrition education isn't just information dissemination. We have to think about the environment and other factors that can influence people's behaviors and incorporate that into our nutrition education programs.
Mm-hmm. The other piece that I would add is look to your students as an incredible source of innovation and work and ideas. They are really the engine that drives this, at least the fresh education component. They are dedicated, they work hard, they're incredibly creative, and they're using social media in ways that I can't even envision. And so we give them a lot of responsibility, but they also shine when they're given that responsibility, and they take ownership over the program. We have students who have been in the grad program and developed these program components, which is one their assignment for the grad course, and they are so proud of it that when they go out to work, they tell people, you know, I was part of that program. I helped develop that program, and that ownership carries on far beyond graduation. And so they get a real sense of what it's like to talk with people who ask really difficult questions. They get a chance to show how creative they can be. They're incredibly organized. We've got minutes from our meetings in minutes because they're typing them on their laptops. Like, you know, for old people like us, that's really cool, but they just take it as very normal. So we have to give them a lot more leeway and a lot more credit for what they can do if we just give them a bit, you know, give them a bit of leeway.
Yeah. And it makes sense because they are the target audience for this program.
Absolutely.
So having that immediate feedback is probably what helped make the program as successful as it sounds like it has been doing. So that's great. Good learning experience for them as well.
Absolutely.
I guess we have one last question. So they were wondering, and maybe you have mentioned this during your presentation, but what statistical tests were performed for the data?
Mm-hmm.
I know you showed a bunch of tables.
Right. So every table is probably a slightly different statistical test.
Uh-huh.
In the paper, we do go through it in detail, both in the method section and at the and at the bottom of each table, specifically tables 3, 4, and 5, we provide a fair bit of detail. So some of the proportions and whatnot were assessed with using a chi-square. Sometimes we did a one-sample t-test when we were comparing the respondents, what they said, how many servings should be in a how many servings are in a food group recommendation compared to what was actually the recommendation. That would have been a one-sample t-test. When we were comparing across groups, so in tables 4 and 5, even table 3, 4 and 5, where we were comparing across groups like discipline, we would have used a repeated measures ANOVA, an ANOVA, sorry, not repeated measures. So there are a lot of complicated statistical analyses in there, but we did try to, in the paper, lay it out fairly clearly. So my suggestion would be to just go back and take a thorough look at that if you're interested in the statistical test.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. At this time, there aren't any other questions, but I'm sure if anybody else has future questions, they could reach out to either one of you to get more information. Again, thank you again for such a lovely presentation. And I will let Rachel close out today's webinar.
Thank you. Yes, great presentation. Just a reminder, I'll send an email by Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording that we made today, as well as the slide then handout and the CEU certificate that you earned from your attendance. When I close the session, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback. And I'll also let you know that we are going to do 10 webinars as part of the Journal Club. We have finalized the schedule. Some of those have not yet been put in to go to webinar, but we've added dates. I believe it's November 21st as well as October 31st. So we'll be getting, if you have requested to be registered for all the sessions, we'll go ahead and do that here shortly. But otherwise, you might watch for some additional sessions that were added into the Journal Club. Thank you for your attendance today. We will see you back. Our next Journal Club webinar, I believe, is October 3rd. So we'll take a break. We'll see you back in 2 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you.